Today's show is brought to you by the Star City Murders.
Yes, the new film of mine, The Star City Murders, is out everywhere now. You can get it on Amazon Prime Video, Apple TV, Vudu, many platforms, satellite cable for rent or purchase. It's great. We also have a DVD and Blu-ray release. So if you're into serial killer, thriller, detective stories, this is the movie for you. Check it out today, baby.
All right, welcome back to Podcast Winterfell. It has been since October 22nd of 2022, but we are back to talk about House of the Dragon, Season 2, Episode 1, Man, a Son for a Son, and that it was. My name is Axel. I'm here with Gina, and of course, it's the first episode. The originator, the creator himself, Matt Murdock, is with us. We're going to chat with everyone in just a second, but we just want to remind you to head on over to dvrpodcast.com. Find out about all the awesome pods we're doing. Actually, Heath and Andy and I are now covering Mayor of Kingstown. And I've also been jumping on with Amy from Little Miss Recap and covering McBee Dynasty, a very silly and fun reality show if you're into that. So check out dvrpodcast.com. You can join our Facebook group. You can also become a patron and help support us at patreon.com/DVR. And well, I mean, we're back. The dragons are flying. We're back in Westeros. I am super excited. Gina, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to be potting about this again. I did a whole rewatch of season one before, and it was great to do. Like, it was kind of a nice revisitation and got me really excited about this season.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I'll tell my story after we introduce Matt. Matt, the creator, Podcast Winterfell, wouldn't exist without you. Please tell everyone you have a podcast on this show too, and you've been working with the guys over at the Triple Double PP Podcast Network. Please talk to us. Tell us how we can find and hear more, Matt.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's so great to be with you and Gina again. You guys are fabulous. Thanks for that. Before the Dragon Podcast is the name of the House of the Dragon Podcast. And then, yeah, everything that Double P Media does, at the word double, the letter P, the word media on YouTube, and on the socials, it's the word double, the letters PHQ. That's a place where you find all the good stuff with Bubba and Catfish. And I occasionally contribute with a little bit of music analysis and that type of thing over there. That's my big thing that I like to do. And this year, I'm making it a point to make a big musical episode every season, or for each episode of House of the Dragon as it airs.
Yeah.
And it's so fun because I've been working my butt off for like 4 months. I have been working so hard. And then you guys just come on and you'll, you know, shoot up the rankings and everything while I'm still sitting at the bottom. And it's just because, outside of the music, there's really not a whole lot that anybody wants to hear from me about.
No, that is not true. You bring lots of amazing insights, Matt.
Well, you're very kind, Axel, but it is a pleasure to be here. I can't wait to get to talking about this episode. I was really excited about it. Didn't rate it probably quite as high as I thought I might have, but it's still really good.
Yeah. Yeah. This episode, to me, the thing that it invoked in me is, and I was talking to my wife, we waited to watch until last night because I'm a little backed up doing a lot of podcasting, had to do a Mayor Kingstown rewatch. I was kind of late. I couldn't get back into the first season for some reason. I just was starting it and stopping it and starting it. And then I was just like, you know what? Let me just put this on. You know, I love building Lego. I'll build a little Lego. And it just seeps into me. And I just look up at some point and I am there. I'm in Westeros. I'm feeling it. And I definitely got sucked back in more, I realized, with season one after they made the age change when they jumped the 10 years into episode 6.
Oh. Interesting.
I just felt I liked it so much better. And I didn't, it was like a different show to me. I don't know. I loved it the first time around and I loved it even more. I picked up so many little things that I didn't pick up before. And this episode, having watched this season is only 8 episodes. Last season was 10. So we're getting a few less episodes. But after going from 10 to 1, just felt seamless to me. Obviously, some of the people look a little older, especially the younger kids, right? You can mm-hmm. notice that. But it felt seamless. And this episode really felt like Game of Thrones to me. House of the Dragon felt so much like a, what do they call that? Like a parlor? I don't know, like a talker, right? Where the people are just kind of in rooms. There was a lot of people. Let's all get the family together and talk. And this felt traveling, right? We're going to Winterfell. We're going to the Wall. Things are happening. It just, I loved it. I have no complaints. I was sucked in.
I think season one, there had to be a lot of setup. There's a lot of still education, even for people who were Game of Thrones watchers, if they weren't necessarily book readers or listeners. It was, you know, kind of setting up the stage. And yeah, maybe somewhat more boring in a way. But no, I see where you're coming from for sure.
Yeah. Matt, any thoughts on my feelings there? What you said your rating wasn't as high. Why is that?
Well, as a book reader, I had certain expectations for certain scenes that did appear in this episode, and I was a little confused by some of them. But other than that, I mean, the drama was still great. Rhaenyra only said like 4 words the entire episode. Yeah. But she didn't need to say anything more than that for me to feel what she was feeling. Emma Darcy, they did a fantastic job with that.
Yeah.
I think there's probably a little bit of confusion as to what exactly happened with Helena at the end in terms of a book reader standpoint. But other than that, it wasn't a bad episode. It just, I guess what I'm saying is I had certain expectations and some of those expectations that I shouldn't have probably held with me coming into the thing, we're not met. Let's just put it that way.
We've been down that road, haven't we, Matt?
couple of times.
We've talked.
I'm not going to quit
for a decade now.
I'm not going to quit the show, folks. Don't worry. I'm not going to.
No,
quit
I remember guess, that yes. episode. I was shocked. I was like, oh no.
I know. I know that there's been. Yeah. For those who read the book, they know there's some differences that happened. And I think as always happens when something is adapted, they make decisions because they have their own plan or they feel it works better for the story they're telling on the screen. So I can understand where you're coming from. Like I said, I read this so long ago and then listened when I still re-listened to this book. Because it's so fun, but I always skip ahead, I should say.
Yeah.
So I didn't have the same feelings, but I get where you're coming from. You know, you have an attachment to this world and this story, and it's hard to shake. Like I said, when I'm sitting there and all of a sudden I look up from my Lego instructions and I'm like, oh my God, I'm here. Like I've been sucked in. This is a world that really gets you so excited and interesting. And that's just a testament to how much you care about the story.
I suppose so. It could also just be boiling over frustration for waiting 13 years for another book of George's to come out in the proper series.
Oh, it's never going to happen.
I'm not settled
on that.
I'm not going to say that, but I think that your expectations are correct there, Gina.
I think it's a little interesting too, though, because this story has been told in a book, but not in the same detail and way that the Song of Ice and Fire series is told from this first person perspective. This is a history book, which they say many times, well, hey, you know, hey, maybe Mushroom was right. You know what I'm saying? Like there's so many perspectives. And I saw an interview with Ryan Condal where he said, the book has many perspectives. We're one of those perspectives, right? So when we change things, we feel like, hey, this is the story that this history is told, you know? So I kind of dig that. That makes me feel a little bit better about things, you know?
I think my biggest problem is that the perspective that they tend to lean towards is that of happenstance. There doesn't seem to be any clear, you know, let's look back at last season. Like, it was Vhagar that attacked Arrax while Aemon said no. Of course, Aemon should have actually, you know, never gone after Lucerys in the first place. Mm-hmm. So the responsibility is still his own. But those kind of intentions aren't really outlined in the book. And usually it's the fact that Alicent misunderstood what Viserys was saying when he said his dying words. All of this stuff just seems to be one big mistake, you know, or one thing where our main characters aren't really in control of the actions that happen thus far. You know, this is a war.
Yeah. It's an interesting point. People are,
you know.
Yeah.
No, that is an interesting point. And I think, you know, how, I mean, it kind of begs the question, can someone really control a dragon and a dragon's actions, even if they're bonded with it?
Yep.
Right.
That's a big question.
That is actually a conversation that I got into with my son and my wife at dinner last night when my wife asked me to bring her up to speed because she didn't do the rewatch with me and we were about to watch this episode. And I kind of talked about that, about how there is, I think, in what's, I always mix it up. It's Fire and Blood, right? That's the name of the book. I always get the book wrong. Mm-hmm. I always say something different, but Fire and Blood, there is a theme there, right? And I think in the Game of Thrones story of what Gene is saying, which is like the dragons having an agency in a sense, and the magic and the world moving the people instead of the other way around. Like, we're so, especially in America, we have this thing like the strong man stands up and changes history. And I kind of enjoy that perspective, Matt. I kind of enjoy, I know it seems to take agency away from our characters, but I like that it gives agency to the dragons, the magic, and the like the movement of time and history will happen regardless of the people, in a sense. And I kind of enjoy that. I liked that aspect of it. It's interesting to me. You know, does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I think one of the things that book readers of Fire and Blood really enjoy is, you know, George started this whole let's solve a mystery together through the books with the R plus L equals J, right? All the way through. And with these three different perspectives, there's a lot of things that book readers have done to either put things together in some cases correctly, in some cases maybe not, but that's not for me to judge. That's part of the fun of it.
Yeah.
The problem a television show has, and I guess the way that they're trying to compensate for it is say, oh, well, it was just a mistake. It wasn't anybody's fault. So you can still think whatever you think in the books. And that's fine. I mean, I think that's really the only way a television show can do it. I mean, how many times do you want to go through an episode where we go back and see the same events through Mushroom's perspective, through Munkin's perspective?
Right.
You can't do that.
Rashomon.
So, I think it's the proper approach. It just because they've chosen that same type of idea that, well, it was a mistake. And God knows humans make mistakes. Dragons do too. But it just feels like it's too many mistakes. Mm. And like I said, I don't think that this is going to last much longer because we're going to get into full on war and somebody's going to have to order somebody to go kill somebody and that kind of thing. Right. So I'm not too worried about, battles being a mistake, even though a lot of times battles are actually, that could be the one thing that could be a mistake is just, think of Gettysburg where they just kind of stumbled on each other.
Yeah.
So those kind of things are very interesting. And I'm trying to open my mind to it. I think you've got a great point, Axel. I'm not trying to belittle your point at all. I'm just again, clinging to mine. That's
all. And I think even, you know, it's supposed to be a history, but something I noticed, and I don't remember them talking about the scorpions in the book, and it also seems like it took them a really long time to figure out the scorpion weapon in Game of Thrones with Daenerys. and yet here we see them like at the ready. And I was kind of like, I feel like a maester somewhere really dropped the ball if it took them forever to figure out a weapon to kill the dragons in Game of Thrones. And so, you know, I think we can, you know, kind of the grace of it being a history and parts of history being even in the United States completely being not studied in school or even known about until
lost,
you know, we're out of school. Yeah. I think there's something there. And I've always kind of felt because they do have a weirwood tree at the palace, I've always felt anything that happens in front of that weirwood tree is the only thing we can trust because the weirwood network is it's a network. And that can be like a single source of truth, though. You know, I mean, there's no record of what the weirwood trees knows anywhere, but I just think someone is observing this moment in time of, you know, the three-eyed raven is. So we can guess that this is something that probably actually happened. That's the way I logicize it.
That's Bran's YouTube, you know, he's just like flipping back and forth watching. Hey, you make a great point, Gina, about lost history. I mean, we're recording this on Juneteenth, and you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If anything says about how a nation, a people can obscure, hide, destroy their own history, that says it, right? So we see it in our own world, and that's why we love this story. And that's why I love it, because I think George just did such an amazing job there. You know, the connections are everywhere and it just sweeps you up into it. I have a question for you, which is Matt mentioned it earlier. Do you think that Aemon told anyone that what happened, or does it? Because that's a question I had when watching the show, seeing the two back to back. Right? I mean, like the dragon attacks, and Arryx and Luke die, and then we're right in. We see Rhaenyra's face, and then now we're right into this episode, you know? Mm-hmm. There's no, and that's the way Game of Thrones, you know, these shows where time moves pretty quickly. We hear vaguely a week or this, but we see already, you know, Allison's getting busy already, you know what I'm saying? Like, that wasn't happening last season, right?
Yeah, Aemon did tell them, because I think he told them, they all realized it was a fuck-up mistake. And Allison wrote Rhaenyra a letter that she probably hasn't seen, because I think she immediately went out and started looking for proof of death of Luke.
Yeah.
So there's reference to the letter in it. So he did come clean. But that actor just always has such a smirk on his face that it's hard to tell if he's ever.
Well, that's but it's
the way his mouth is. Well,
when you say came clean, do you mean he said, the dragon acted on its own? I did not mean to kill this kid and this dragon. That's what I mean.
Yeah, I think he did, because I think when Alicent wrote to Rhaenyra, they kind of referenced it being a horrible mistake.
Okay. That
accident. I must have missed.
That's interesting to me. That's
that was during the council, right?
Yeah.
You know, when they were talking about that. And I think what you still have to look at is you still see Allison blaming Aemon a lot. And that should be enough information to know that, you know, she holds him responsible, which she should, because the dragon wouldn't be there if he hadn't sent the dragon after Luke, as I keep saying over and over. Yeah. But so I think there is an implication there that everybody knows, and even the camp, the Team Black, the Team Rhaenyra camp, is informed, even if Rhaenyra hasn't learned anyway. But I mean, enough to say that she wants Aemon. The only four words that she had in the whole episode says that she's laying the blame there too.
Yeah.
So everybody must know at this point.
He just looks so villainous that
he does. Right?
Like, I love that really guy does. In The Last Kingdom. He's so good in The Last Kingdom. It's so innocent, so sweet. Yeah. And then really good actor, because, you know, I it's like I have to flip a coin every week. Who do I hate more this week? Amond or Damon? Amond or Damon? I do that every week.
Both of them
week.
Are so good together. Like, I love yeah. them both. It's like, of course, they're both like the dark, in some ways, the most evil, but they're also just like, I love that so they compelling. Cast them so closely together because they have the same twinkle in their eye. They're so similar. And I don't know. I love them both.
Amon's twinkle is brighter when he takes the patch off.
And
it is.
What faces, really? This show, I mean, this show has always done to Game of Thrones as well. The faces that they cast are incredible. And you could just, I mean, it's just the lines, you know, he's almost like an anime character or something
Everybody is so beautiful, yeah. Axel. It makes me sick.
It's crazy. You're so captivated.
Even the casting of Lord Commander Stark at the Wall. You know, another, like, of course, he's like the perfect Stark Northman.
Yeah, you're right. He was great. Yeah, he was great. And that voice, they threw me with the voiceover in the beginning. And then it turns out it was him. But it's weird because you see when he says the 1 in 10, one in every 10 men from Winterfell go to the Wall. Mm-hmm. And then I turn to my wife and I say, you see, back then they were running the Wall right. This was before it was a bunch of criminals and thieves and rapists and murderers that went to the Wall. This was a thing of honor that you should go, right? Like you were drafted into it, mm-hmm. Which I thought, that's interesting. I wonder if people noticed that kind of thing, which I thought was really interesting. I like the way the voiceover just, you see someone else's journey, the kid who's chosen, but then it's him at the end. And I think that says something about the connection between the common people, like the way the Starks are seen and the way the North is seen, where there's more of a connection between the commoners and the royals, I guess you'd say, right? Than there is maybe in King's Landing where he comes from. Like we still do the dirty deeds out here in the cold.
Yeah, think about it. Why is he sending 2,000 old men down to King, to fight Rhaenyra's war as opposed to the men that he needs? There's much more of a sense of community in the North, which is one of the things I think that drew us to the Starks in the first place.
Yeah.
Other than the fact that they were portrayed as the heroes of the story when Game of Thrones came out, it still feels like you're in an element that is outside of your control. So you better team up or you better, so I can definitely see how there would be more of an empathy between those who lead and I guess you would call them the common folk of the North.
Yeah. Well, and I think it was also a nice entry because there's something about one realizing there is a bigger cause than just everyday life and themselves to be mindful of and to kind of align against. And I think that's something that, a former king's name.
I don't know.
Aerys? No. Why am I saying that wrong? The king that died.
Oh, Viserys.
Viserys. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So Viserys, you know, he was always telling Rhaenyra, there is something bigger that's going to happen. This song of Fire and Ice, the kind of tale on the dagger. And I kind of felt like them looking out over the Wall and what, you know, young Commander Stark was saying was, you know, they were kind of aligned. So I think it's like a different generation's way of thinking. And then perhaps it's like this war that kind of breaks all that down and where a lot of kind of tradition and that mindset is lost. Yeah.
Yep. The disintegration of it. And when we pick up in Game of Thrones, it's already in that state, right? And it's going to its final throws, which then result in the end, which seems to be a better way of people treating each other and right and rulers ruling and King Bran and all that. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But I skipped past something that I didn't see. And Gina, you have amazing notes, as everyone knows. Legendary. And you said there's a new intro. I didn't see it because I have a thing about blood. I don't even want to talk about it. I don't like blood.
So I don't, no worries anymore, Axel.
No worries. It's the new intro is amazing. It's no longer that weird blood vault crest thing. It's a tapestry being formed of the history. It's great. I'm so happy they changed it. I had an idea for a different intro because I hated the old one so much. I thought they should be doing kind of like a family tree of dragons and dragon riders, you know, and like show eggs hatching and then them linking up with a person. That was like kind of my idea to help people kind of keep it straight. But the tapestry is great. Yeah, I really like it.
It's very similar.
Yeah.
So many moments of history from Targaryen history are in that tapestry.
Yeah.
Kelly had to go through it with me like many, many times in order for me to catch them all. But if you have read, for book readers, if you have read Fire and Blood, you'll recognize a lot of scenes just from that on its own that will really stand out to you. And just gorgeous. I mean,
yeah, it's beautiful.
It's still not my favorite of intros. The old map before season 8 is still my favorite, but I think this one runs a close second.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's much improved over season 1's intro.
I am very happy to hear this because I love doing a nice interpretive dance during the opening theme song. Where it's, I mean, I don't know, Matt, you do that too, right? Don't you do an interpretive dance when the theme song comes on?
Absolutely, except I usually end up on my face by the end of it.
Well, that's part of the dance, though. That's what makes you.
Everybody dies in the Game of Thrones, so do I. I just fall on my face.
It's very theatrical. I like that. Yeah. Okay, I'll watch it now again because, I don't know. I'm just like, I'm one of those people, like when I get my blood taken, I have to look away. I'm not good with that kind of stuff. So I'm very, very happy to find out that there is no more 2.5 minutes of blood going through some a tapestry. I like that. And I felt too, it didn't really, that felt more like a statement to me than something that felt like part of the story, you know? So that's why I didn't like that. So this tapestry thing sounds cool. All right, what else we got? Oh, you have Damon here. Yeah, I like to talk about that. I thought I was waiting going into this episode. I'm like, how long is it going to take someone to get really mad at now I'm going to pronounce the name Rhaenys, right? Who chose not to burn everyone to death.
Yeah, that was one of the things during the rewatch. I was like, girl, you could have just ended it all right there.
And then I went back and listened to us say the same thing last year or a year and a half ago. Like, she had the opportunity to, and Damon says it like as soon as he can. And I was like, thank you. Thank God he said this really quickly because somebody had to say it. And I'm so glad that someone did. Because that moment and I feel like that moment will be brought back again.
I do. And, you have to wonder about someone's intentions when they decide to not interfere, which it seems like she's involved, but she's not involved.
Which is bullshit.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, which is bullshit.
Yes, because I think her personal motivation is to sit back, watch these guys destroy themselves and finally get the throne. Like she says, she doesn't care anymore, but all these mofos care. So that's kind of like, I mean, that wasn't necessarily in the history and we don't have proof of that, but I could see this playing into a line somewhere.
Yeah. I think I was just glad that it was said. And I think I love her. She just, exactly what you're saying, it's changed because remember too that the sea snake was like, let's just go away from all of this. I don't want to fight it. It was our thirst for the crown has cost us our children, right? Because they still think their son's dead, which he's not. I wonder if we're going to see him again. At some point, we must. So I thought that that was an interesting point for him to bring that back, because I think that that's going to be something that we're going to have to watch out for, because I think that that thirst, the death of her children has actually given her that thirst, where before it actually was her husband, right? Like it's transferred and he doesn't want that anymore, but she does. And I just like that. Damon is the best. It's like you have to, he's awful. Like I forgot that moment when he just grabs Rhaenyra by the throat when she starts talking about Aegon's vision and dream last season. That to see that was only a couple of days in the time that we're seeing this. So it's interesting. I mean, with the death of her son and all that, but he's so weird too. How do you guys interpret the way he acts towards her? Similarly, the way he acted when she lost their baby in the finale last year, and when the way he acted when his first wife was not being able to give birth, eventually kills herself by dragonside, I guess you would call it. But what is that? Is that he just can't ever care about anyone else? Is he so blocked? Is it evil? Is it, I don't know how to describe it. How do you see that?
Gina, I don't know how you feel about this, but the way I always picture Damon is he's kind of incapable of handling really deep emotion. And so he distances himself from loss quite a bit. On the other hand, you do see that he's more than willing to act on what he perceives to be Rhaenyra's behalf at the end of this episode. So it's not that, and he wants to take Vhagar out. At the beginning of the episode, he wants revenge for what happened to Luke. And so he's thinking about Luke, even when he makes the accusation at Rhaenys. So it's not that he doesn't feel these things, but I almost kind of get the sense that he has to distance himself from them in order to, I don't know, keep from hurting himself in some way or another. It didn't hurt with his very first wife.
Yes, you're
he didn't have any trouble taking care of that.
Yeah, that's true. The horse helped too.
Right.
But they even played that down, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're right, Matt. I think he's, you know, kind of afraid to go all in with a person. I think even, you know, when he was initially trying to seduce Rhaenyra, when she was the younger version in the pleasure house, I think he held back because I think he was like afraid to potentially. Like he loves her, but I think he was afraid to love her.
To feel something.
And to do that. And it was kind of finally when they were both, you know, older and had experienced some loss. Like, you know, maybe he wasn't too upset over his first wife because, you know, it was, he kind of married her because, you
he
know,
kind of had
Rhaenyra,
to.
Because Rhaenyra was marrying her brother. Rhaenyra was off the market. So, at least you kind of keep out all the family, which the Targaryens are very good at. But yeah, I think he does kind of have an emotional block, and it'll be interesting to see. I have ideas if, when, and how, what happens when that emotional block gets lifted and he's kind of running on fumes of, you know, kind of pure hot love and revenge.
Yeah. Well, Matt Smith plays him fantastic.
Oh,
there's just such a depth there that I just saw that in his face. But it's like you're saying, he still, though, conversely, he leans into the, oh, I get a chance to kill a motherfucker now, right? Like when that happens and he has the opportunity to hurt and to lash out, he'll do it without a moment's notice. So it's just an interesting dynamic that he has. with that. And of course, he wants Aemon, Aemon and the dragon dead, and he wants revenge, and he's been calling for war from the very beginning. But I feel like too, I'm always suspicious of him. I too believe that he too thinks that he should be king. So
yes.
Would that you would be king, yes, says Rhaenys. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's like, come on, punk, lay off. Yeah. You're the boss of me.
So I don't know, where do you guys want to go next? What's interesting
well,
you
for if now? We're talking about Daemon, I don't want to get too far into what ultimately happens at the end of this episode, but I am sad to see that Bad Accent, aka the White Worm, is back, although it seems like her accent is not as convoluted, like it actually
toned down.
Yeah, yes. Like it actually sounded more like she was speaking in whatever her normal accent might be, which is good because I just could not stand it. I don't know. Did we even really need her to live and to come back to just like be the pawn in Daemon being able to access the castle? It was pretty weak, I thought. I mean, I don't know.
I agree. I was one of the things in the rewatch and coming into this season, I had to kind of remind my wife, oh, she's the lady, remember? And earlier she had a thing with Daemon and all that kind of stuff. They're trying to develop a B plot here and someone that they, a character that they can turn to as a kind of a fixer in a way, right? To relay information or I feel like I didn't understand what the purpose was, because after finding her and talking to her, and then he's like, has to do some sort of negotiation. It seems as though he ends up using his own connections to get back into King's Landing and do all that, right? Like, he knew the guy who was in the King's Guard. The guy recognizes him. It did not seem, what information did she give him? Just about the rat catcher? Just who the that's it.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem too deep. Like, he could have asked a guard that. Like, hey, who's somebody who gets to know us around? The guard could have been like, oh, the rat catcher. And they go, okay, let's go see him. Because it's not like, I don't know.
I think the crucial thing here is that Missaria knew that this guy would actually do something like this. And there may only be a few people that she knows of that would actually be capable or willing to carry that out. And so that's why that was kind of important. But the rat catcher, believe me, he didn't impress me all that much. We can talk about that later. But I wasn't all that impressed with it.
Should we talk a little bit about the weirdest new love triangle in the House of the Greens, which is Alicent, Sir Christian Cole, and Lord Creepyfoot Fetish?
Oh man. She's got a lot of beautiful suitors there, doesn't she? That was pretty quick. I mean, because this did not happen. We are to believe that she would only do this after the king died, right?
Right.
You would think so, yeah.
Okay. Because my impression always was that she truly loved the king, and she and part of what my feeling is, they built up such tension with the mothers really protecting their children and their families, right? Being their main motivation here, in a way that I felt I never felt through, say, Cersei, you know, I love my children. And then acts crazy. Like, this is different. I feel like they actually, even though some of the children are horrible, they actually want that. So I was kind of a little surprised that, you know, right away when they cut to just her face, they wanted to try to trick you. Like, okay, who's going down on her? Like, who is it? And I think most people knew who it was. It wasn't going to be footman.
Right. You know? Yeah.
I can almost find a way to justify her getting to this business with Kristen so quickly. And that is that.
Sure.
I don't imagine Viserys was in any shape for many years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, holy shit. I'm afraid something might fall off. I'm throwing.
Yes. Oh, God. Could you imagine that? I mean, no.
Ooh. Yeah.
With half a face and everything, too. No, the sores. No, you're right, Matt. That's she was in need of some tenderness there, and she got it. And I think I like the way his attitude has changed, right? Because in the past we've seen him get dissed and dismissed. So he, when she was like, "This is the last time we can do this," and he's like, "Yeah, right. What's next on? We go get breakfast or what, lady? Where's my coffee?
Yeah.
We got a council meeting to go to. I'll see you later. Yeah.
Put on your knickers and let's get out of here."
But it's interesting too, because that scene, along with some other scenes here, and we get to the point where she is talking about being undermined, right? And what power she now has. And we saw, right? We kind of saw that, we've seen this before, where for a second she's very powerful and vying with her dad to get to the sun and blah, blah, blah. But once the sun is installed, what power does she really have?
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know that she's, yeah. And that's a whole conversation that she has with her father. And it's like, you undermine me in front of them. Yeah. And they're influenced by that. And little does she know, they're also being influenced by her part-time lover, Sir Christian Cole, as well as now Lord Strong, a.k.a. Lord Foot Fetish. So it's she, I don't know, Christian Cole says something like, he says
a cunning spider.
Yes. Oh, she was
a cunning spider. She and she you know, kind of wove a web, and your mother was caught in it. And I was like, dude, you were the one caught in that.
Exactly.
But I think Allison's in the process of getting caught in another web, because she has forces working against her. Even the force that's on her side seems to kind of be undermining her, and I think she's, whatever power she got up to this point, I think she's going to see it
dwindle.
Dwindle rather quickly. I think her children are going to be uncontrollable. Her Lord Strong is going to be uncontrollable. I can already tell that guy, who's like the worst combination possible of Littlefinger and Varys, is definitely gunning to be Hand of the King.
Gina, I looked at this episode and I think, okay, well, yes, everybody's thinking about war and everything. If we love the political aspect of it, Larrys is probably the only one who's actually playing the Game of Thrones right now. Right?
Yes, you know, I agree.
He's gotten the internet shut off by Allison, so he can't get the wiki feet. He's got... Oh my God. He's seeing Otto there. He killed somebody to put Otto in the Hand of the King position, but now he wants that. Clearly, by the way that he's talking to Aegon.
He killed his father.
And his brother. Yeah.
Killed and his brother. Yeah.
His father to put Otto in that position. Yeah, I mean,
he's
so bad. Yeah. He's wiping out, you know, staff members that might be unfaithful to the crown, you know, and the whole thing, like, Allison feels dirty. She feels dirty about all of it.
Hence
her back, where she's like literally scrubbing away at herself.
Oh, it was the old hands of, what was that, Hamlet? Isn't that Hamlet with the washing of, or Macbeth?
Oh,
Macbeth.
Out dance.
Washing the hands. And, but also because that was great. That was a great scene, because she's also surrounded by all the people that Larrys put there and who are watching her now. Mm-hmm. Oh, Queen, I heard you were away from your quarters for a long period of time. What were you doing? Right? Like, so she's being the very women she trusts. And in a sense, there's so much happening in the show, we don't get to see the mourning, but her handmaiden, who was snitching on her, is now dead and gone, right? Everybody's been replaced, and then washing herself like that. I thought that was a great, she's awesome.
Yeah.
I think that all of this stuff that happened in the episode surrounding her character and the change that we see was, for me, one of my favorite parts of the episode. And yeah, Laris is definitely, he's making his moves. And yeah, I think you're right. Wiki Feet was turned off, Matt. I like that. That's a good one. he gets no more.
Sorry, folks.
That did nothing for me.
Yeah, I know. She's like, look, dude, he's doing a little bit more than looking at my feet, okay?
Yeah, it got creepy, and so she had to cut that off as soon as Viserys died.
Well, that was, I remember watching that, when upon rewatching that, I felt to myself, I could really see that, her character, the projection of that, turning her face while he's whacking it, of like, just the way she's like, man, you know what? Those other motherfuckers don't have to do this to get what they want. You know what I'm saying? Like that it has to go that way. And I think to see it not going any better, like Jean is saying, I don't see a way for her to gain power. It's not as if all these crazy men around her are going to become sane, including her children, right? That's not what's going to happen. So, not good things are not ahead for Allison.
Yeah.
You got to be the queen. Mm-hmm. Look what you get. Not always good. All right. Axel brought the podcast down.
Yeah. No, really, for Allison, I think the height of her power was actually while Viserys was still alive, but too sick to come to the councils, too sick to come to the throne. Yes.
Yeah.
And everything since has started to deteriorate, like you said, rapidly since then. So I do feel bad for Allison. She's not my favorite character by any means. And I'm not a big fan of her and Kristen Cole being together just because I hate Kristen Cole. But that doesn't mean that I don't feel feelings for, like you said, Gina, with that bath thing. She was washing all of that sin off. The fact that they had installed Aegon on, the fact that Aemon had done what Aemon had done, the fact that, you know, she had done things herself through Larys or whatever. And now the fact that you think about Allison as much devoted to the Seven as she is, how she probably just feels terrible to herself, guilty for having sex out of wedlock.
Yeah, Matt, I forgot about the old Seven part, right? Like, she has really turned to the religion. And I don't think it doesn't seem to me that this is like the Cersei way to get power. This is a real, like, it seems to me to be a true believer type thing.
Yeah.
And
I agree.
That I could see that getting ratcheted up in her as well. Yeah, because you're right. It's just like they're having a nice moment, right? Sir Criston Cole's down on his knees. He gets up and the first thing she's like, we can't do this again. I mean, you know, it's like, come on. It's like, this is like, I feel like I'm back at Catholic school or something.
Yeah, she's not the most emotionally intelligent.
No. I mean, we've seen from her, right, being pushed to like the marriage and the way her father, it's a long tale. I would like to talk a little bit about our king.
Okay.
Our king Aegon.
Long may he reign.
Long may he reign.
He's so magnanimous. Oh, yes.
What does that mean? I thought that they did a really great job in this episode of making this guy, who was really in the four or five episodes he appeared in last season, not the most interesting character, very despicable. We saw he raped one of the handmaidens, right? And he's drinking when he's younger and doing all this crazy. She's always been kind of crazy. He doesn't want to be the king. But now we see him, he's strutting. He's like, motherfucker, I'm the king. And I kind of like him hanging out at the throne with all his like CW buddies in front of him. And they're like, what the fuck, man? I'm the king. Like, I really liked it. I thought that it was kind of funny. And I thought it was kind of almost, they were almost making fun of the typical teenage kid on a TV show. kind of thing. And I really loved it. And I thought that this actor, something happened over here. And someone said to him, like he did, or his agent, or someone was like, "You're the king now." You know, they got some good direction, or there, because he really is a much more interesting character to me in this one episode.
You know, yeah. I saw a little interview with the actor that plays him, and there was some or something. There was some decision he made to start reading some of the lines more humorously. You know, I mean, consider Joffrey and a lot of, he was just like pure evil, vitriol, like with an evil intention. And I think if some of those lines, if Joffrey was reading these lines, it would be that same way. But I think this, you know, this actor was like, I'm going to kind of throw a little bit of humor in here, because I think you can watch back the season and he can look at both Daemon and he could look at Aemon and be like, you know, I don't have any of that swagger. I'm just kind of like this douchebag that's, you know, drunk and whoring around. And I think maybe he kind of saw that and is like, you know, I can kind of make this funny. It might work for me. And it does.
Yeah. When I looked at the character of Aegon in this particular episode, and I agree, some of that stuff is very humorous, and I think there's an intention there. But the thing that struck me most about Aegon is at the beginning of the episode, he is eager to try and be a good king. He is. Yeah. He's actually quite eager about it, except for, you know, messing with Lord Tywin. But who doesn't want to mess with a Lannister? That's always humorous.
Yeah.
But he's eager, but he's not ready. And I just wonder how that's going to play out given the end of the circumstances of this episode.
Yeah. And I think he sees what he missed out on, because I don't think his dad ever brought him to a council meeting. And so as kind of being a little bit of a shit bringing the kid to the council meeting, I think there is honestly a good intention there. Like, I want to make sure this kid is ready, because I sure the hell wasn't, you know. Yeah. Well, and I guess he really thought he never would be king, because maybe they did honestly thought it would always be Rhaenyra. I don't know. But you would still think you get the kids involved in the family business like Trump does. Anyway.
Now Gina brought down the podcast.
I'm just thinking of, you know, family businesses that are kind of corrupt but and hard difficult to infiltrate.
I think he is that's like the typical teenage-y thing that I feel from him, where he's like, yeah, I'm gonna be the king, and then once they actually start talking about it and he has to do like work and think, it's like, oh, this is fucking boring.
Even Alicent and Otto bring that up. Yeah. Axel, they talk about how the novelty will wear off.
Yeah, right? Trust me. I have an 11-year-old and I'm already seeing this. It's like, yeah, can you put the dishes away? And then I come and there's like water and soap all over the ground and the sink. And he's like, yeah, I put the dishes. I did the dishes. It's like there's no follow through on anything, except my son, of course, is not a disgusting rapist and horrible human, as we've already seen.
Thank God, at 11, that'd be a tough start.
I know.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I think that kind of what we see at the end, obviously, which is his son murdered, seeing that kind of levity in this episode especially was a good choice to make, because when it turns, it's going to really turn, and it's going to give him an opportunity as an actor and as in the context of the story as the king to show who he is really. And I loved him in this episode, and I don't think I'm going to love him much longer, but I thought his performance was noteworthy.
Why does HBO hate Father's Day?
you're so right. Oh,
you think Tyrion killing Tywin.
Yep. Yep.
Arya having to see Ned's head lifted.
Mm-hmm.
And this. They just hate fathers. Although, you know, he doesn't know yet, so I guess technically they got away with it. But jeez, I mean,
well, Matt, we know
HBO
from Lost,
hates Father's Day, man.
A lot of people have daddy issues, Matt. That's
boy, that's for sure. Evidently, the chairman of HBO and Ryan Condal both have daddy issues.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be surprised. I think we got a whole country with daddy issues. Well, let's talk about what happens. I think this whole setup to this murder of the child, which is so, I mean, again, too, this show, always with the fucking sound when something nasty is happening.
It's what got me one time.
I know, Matt, I remember, it's, oh, like I couldn't, you can hear like them trying to cut the head off the kid or whatever. You could just hear it. And that is what I'm almost numb to. As soon as I finished watching this, I think because Andy had asked, like had mentioned on the Mayor of Kingstown pod, something about the rats. I was like, don't say anything. But I kind of, in the back of my head, I kind of know something's going to happen, you know? And I texted him. I was like, this fucking show is going to kill me with the kid deaths. It's just, oh, they just never stop. It really, no matter how numb I think I am, it still gets you, you know? And the way that they plotted this out and the kind of just the smile that Damon had in recruiting these guys and telling them what to do, even though his intention wasn't for the child to be killed, it's still for a son to be killed.
It seems pretty implicit to me that the Gold Cloak, evidently instructions were given a son for a son because he keeps repeating it. Right. And yeah. Since that's the title of the episode,
it's another kind of,
and he's like,
company.
And what if I can't find Amund? And it shows Dave
cuts away
face. And then that it's like dot, dot, dot. That's and so you're true. Like,
You're right. I mean, I shouldn't say, I think that upon finding out that this happens, I doubt Damon's going to go into a rage and say, oh, they killed a child. He'll probably be like, they deserved it. You know what I'm saying? So
he may just emotionally distance himself from it completely. He committed the act of vengeance that he thinks Rhaenyra wanted. And let's move on to the next thing. Cause that keep seems like moving, Damon to me. Yeah.
That's a great point, Matt. Keep it moving. What's the next domino to fall? But I don't know, Gino, what were your thoughts about the whole buildup, the coming in on the boat under the cover of darkness, which we've seen so many times in Game of Thrones too, sneaking in? What'd you think about the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, they spent a lot of time on it. I don't know. It just seemed like a lot of buildup to like a really kind of sad end. It wasn't particularly cleverly done. You know, this wasn't Tyrion sneaking into Tywin's, you know, bedchamber and, you know, kind of literally getting away with murder a couple times. It was just kind of sad and sloppy. And I just felt really bad for Helena. You know, she's such a kind of innocent in everything. And, you know, so sweet. And she had this premonition, you know, she was scared of the rats, not the dragons.
Yep. Right.
Which, you know, this is what the rats brought to her. I don't know. It was just very sad. I know they like had to do it, but it just felt very clunky and clumsy and long and drawn out for such a sad end, I guess. It wasn't as shocking as when, you know, Luke gets chomped by a dragon. You know, that was kind of more, had more kind of fear and anticipation and you know, kind of drama to it. And this was just kind of like, you know, like scene vomit. Sorry, I'm trying to. Oh. It was just like, oh, you know, okay. I guess we've got to do this. Let's just do it in like the least clever. And while it was shocking, it wasn't shocking. Do you know what I mean? It was like, oh, this is really going to happen. Oh, like this? Okay.
Well, let me ask you this, Gina and Axel, if you want to answer too. When Helena points to Jaehaerys, I've seen some debate on this. I also saw a lot of people saying that they just didn't connect with Helena in that moment, which seems weird to me, because I think that the actress played Helena exactly the way that Helena would react.
Yeah.
But given what we know about Helena's character and the way that she's acted in the past, Gina, do you think that she pointed to Jahera straight up, not to trick them, but merely to, because you don't see which one she's actually pointing to. So that helps build the suspense too. But I think that she's always compelled to just tell the truth. That seems very in character for her.
I think that's part of it. And then I also kind of wonder, because she does have premonitions, that she may have had others as well. And she might know that what's to come is even worse, and it might be sparing a child in some ways things that are even worse. Kind of because of the way she referred to Jaehaerys when Aegon came to take him to council. You know, he's very set, and there was kind of a weird vibe there. And so, you know, I don't know. I don't think she really needed to. I don't think she had a strong intention to save one child over another, but there is something about the truth. And then I think she understands a higher truth and more things that can happen. Yeah. I think it's kind of a combination of a couple different things, but yeah, I think she's incapable of lying for sure. Which will be interesting, because she basically walks in on her mother riding Sir Christian with her other child. And so I don't know if she'll be able to keep her mouth shut about that.
Yeah. Sir Christian. Is he the one that was supposed to be at the post that may have been able to stop all of this?
You
know what?
Wow.
I think you're right.
Matt, good
catch. I think you're right.
I don't know. For me, I think she is Helena is the only sympathetic, truly sympathetic character. Mm-hmm. Maybe in the show. I don't know. There's others, but there was an interesting part where when Aegon came to get his son, and she said to him something like, you know, he has to have his routine or something like that. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
So it occurred to me, because there was some talk of Helena being in the context, I know, created some sort of controversy that she kind of acts more autistic or on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. But in this world, of course, we're talking about a different world, right? And there's some similarities we can draw, but also she's magical, right? She has the sight, the vision. And I felt, was she saying that so does her son? Like, was that line of dialogue in there to let us know, and in a way Matt's saying that she chose him because she didn't want that life for him to be her father's son, his father's
that
son.
Was Gina. I wasn't
yeah,
that smart.
Was me.
Gina was very smart.
Then I say that. I apologize. But that
not
I like that.
Not that he had the sight, but that she had foreseen something worse for him, or that things were going to get worse.
Yes, that too, but yeah. Just that she didn't
something
want,
else.
Yeah, didn't want him in the way that he was maybe also could be used, because maybe he was touched with this green seeing or sight, whatever you call it,
maybe,
right?
Yeah,
like her. But it, whatever it was, this Sophie's choice, which it is, right, as we call it, was horrifying.
Yep.
Horrifying. I have no other way to say it. The actress was amazing. And I think, Gina, is the kind of raggedy ass way that this came about is reflected in the raggedy ass ending of two fucking scumbags murdering a child. So I felt that I enjoyed that, not enjoyed, but appreciated the filmmaking of it all, the direction, the tone, the pace, the editing, of it feeling not like some grand caper, but feeling like paying off two scumbags to do something horrific, which is what it was. So that, to me, spoke to what the outcome was. I found it to be captivating, and the whole time I just knew something bad was going to happen. In the back of my mind, I must know that a child was going to die because I listened and read this thing a million times. But I have successfully, maybe it's all the weed, but I have successfully pushed away those memories.
Right.
But it was, to me, it all worked. And the choices they made that are different from the book, Matt, that I know, maybe we'll understand more why they made certain choices. But the way this turned out on screen for me really worked for me.
Yeah, I think to its own degree as a drama,
it
certainly works. I think it was executed as well as it could by the portraying of that. Again, my biggest thing is just like they happened upon this room. Yeah. It's not that like that was the plan. It's not like anything else. Who would they have killed if they hadn't happened upon that room? And you can chalk this up to guys who are just not all that bright taking the first opportunity. So they get an opportunity to get out of there. Just like Cheese really didn't want to go through with it, which was weird for me. But the other thing is, I'm just more worried about the aftermath of this, because you know how you can pretty much predict how Aegon is going to react to this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How is Rhaenyra going to react?
I know. Yes. I think she's going to be pissed.
And push her away from Daemon. And then Matt, that's what I was thinking. Maybe that's where our accent impeded friend comes into play somehow, because that was his former lover, right? So could that be kind of like a subplot of their, you know, he turns to her in some way? I don't know.
Let's hope not. Oh,
God.
You know, we'll see what happens. But that's a great point, Matt. That's a great point, how she'll react to this. Yeah. And we know what the king, but you said something before, which is they stumble upon it was the first. But actually, the first person they stumbled upon was the king. And if his buddies from...
Yeah, but he's got four kings guard around.
That's what I'm saying. If his buddies weren't there, do you think they would have tried to take him out?
Possibly. If he'd have just been drunk alone on the throne.
He's a son, right? Like, he's the ultimate son.
If he was drunk alone on the throne, he still would have had his king's guard then.
Yeah.
There. I think like his friends would have almost been more of a distraction. You know, I think it would have almost been a better opportunity to really catch them off guard. And I'm sure they would have ended up dead for killing him, but I think they probably could have succeeded in killing him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
They wouldn't have got their gold though.
No, yeah, greedy mofos.
Yeah, it's a little too much. All right. Does anyone have anything else they want to say about the Son for a Son? I mean, this isn't going to turn out well.
Only two things. One was an observation when Aegon was sitting on the throne drunk with all his buddies. He was talking about how his brother was as loyal as a hound. And so that reminded me of the Hound. And ironically, they're actually both disfigured as children.
Nice.
So I thought that was kind of an interesting, just kind of note to ponder a bit. But in addition to how Rhaenyra is going to react to this, how do you think his daughters, like, I think everyone on Team Black is going to take some issue with Daemon for this, like, because it's just disgusting. Like, I can't see his daughters being okay with this. I can't see Rhaenys being okay with this. Like, you know, a baby from its crib, basically. The kid was like four or something.
In front of the mother, no less.
Yeah, I think that, like, this might really cause him to be more of a rogue outcast than he's ever been before. I mean, there were years he was estranged from his brother over less, much less than this.
True. It's a good time for him to be, it's a good time for him to go somewhere else and fight.
You know,
I'm going over, I got to go patrol over there. I got to go over, right? Like it seems like it might be a good time for him to be pushed. I don't know. That's what sometimes
he's had his eyes set on Harrenhal, Axel, since since the Black Council episode, since the finale.
Yeah.
So and even, I think Aemon points out the importance of Harrenhal. So
yes, they both do.
Yeah. So there's your two military minds coming to the same conclusion.
They use the same term. We need a toehold in Harrenhal. I was just like, these two are like definitely cut from the same cloth. You know, I mean, birds of a feather.
That was, I like the scenes where they're talking a little war, and the scene with, what's his name? Aemon and the Hand, whose name is escaping me right now, Allison's dad.
Otto.
Otto, right. How could I forget that? That's Aaron Otto, my good buddy Aaron, a hustler. I like that scene where they, and when Kristen Cole, where they're kind of doing their little, planning.
Having a bro, chat over some wine.
I expected Tyrion to walk in and start telling a joke with the wine. You know what I mean? It gave me, this episode did, they're spreading it out more, and it did give me that kind of wider world GOT feel. I have a question before we go, or if we have anything else we want to discuss, which is how, I didn't want to look this up because, like I said, I'm trying to keep my memory as hazy as I can. How many kids does Rhaenyra have with Daemon? At this point, two, right? I thought it was three. Two. Oh, it's three?
I think it's... Well, go ahead, Matt.
No, you go ahead, Gina, because I'm in the dark right now. But I know that two... were introduced to Viserys, right?
Yep.
And I think she was pregnant with the one she lost.
That's what I thought.
That's it. Okay.
So, I think it is just two.
Two. So, she has, right now, four sons, because she had three sons with Strong, right?
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify that, because they never show those two kids again. I don't know if they've ever been, maybe a little bit here and there, but I think they're still like infants or toddlers, right?
Wasn't there a shot in this episode of her just kind of sitting there with them?
Maybe.
Or was that from a trailer? Okay. I'm getting all that stuff confused. Okay. So.
It might be from a trailer. I don't think I saw them, but Helena was sitting with one of them earlier in a scene. I mean, they're all like little white blonde kids, so...
Yeah.
With white blonde mothers.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
I can't tell these white people apart.
I know.
I meant was referred more to their hair, but
freaking crackers.
The white blonde hair, silver hair.
Okay. Another question I have for you now is, conversely, Aemon is not married, right?
No.
Aemon is not married at this point. He has no children.
He's been promised to a Baratheon.
Okay. Yes, that was what he was doing at the Baratheons before he killed Luke by accident.
Yeah. And our king,
he mentioned it in the council,
Our king now just has one daughter. That's it, right? With his sister.
So, yes, but in the books, he has two sons.
I know that's part of the thing they changed from book to.
So, must be,
but in the show he had, okay, I just want to get it straight, because a lot of shit flies fast, and with kids it's important to kind of take stock.
Somewhat fewer kids, because I do think that Daemon and Rhaenyra's actually ended up having four kids together in Bookland, but I don't
maybe
think
it's been brought down to two.
I think, for the sake of you know, having a ton of babies on set, probably.
Okay. Yeah, cool. Child actors. And
yeah.
You got to get doubles for them sometimes and all that stuff. Yep. So. Yeah.
Kids, animals, and water. Three things you don't want to work with in film. all right. Does anyone have anything else they want to talk about for this episode?
What kind of plan do you think that Amond and Sir Criston were making when they were looking at that map?
Interesting. I should watch that scene again. It looks like they were talking about kind of a flanking maneuver, if I got it correct, right? Like
they were talking about gathering up troops from one place,
yeah,
and then he moved them to another. He moved the discs to another place. I think there's, you know, they seem to be planning their own offensive, and Otto kind of clamped down on that with Amond after they dismissed Criston. But I thought that that was very interesting to look at that map.
I like that you mentioned that map, because so many times on Game of Thrones, we've had very quick things that later on we've seen have been really important to the strategy of war, right?
Right.
But it also begs the question, why aren't they letting them do that? I don't understand that. They seem to be the warriors. Who is Otto? Is Otto thinks that he should be the one coming up with all the plan? It just
Otto seems, and Allison are control freaks.
Yeah, it's
well, and they're trying to prevent a full blown war at this point.
Too late.
Like but they're still trying to exercise as much restraint as possible, considering it was their side good that point. Dealt the first blow. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good point. They're still you're correct, Gina, because they are still marshaling their forces, right? And taking stock of the different houses and all that kind of stuff. So that's interesting too. And I like that too, because that kind of that reminds me of when they did that in Game of Thrones, right? When they went around I kind of like that. Okay.
So the status of Team Aegon right now is Tywin's got an army coming from the Westerlands towards the Riverlands, I suppose. Otto has some of Hightower troops coming also to the Riverlands, I think is what he said, but I'm not sure about that. Is that right, Gina?
Yeah, I believe they all feel the Riverlands and Harrenhal, like from both sides, is like the place to be and the place to have control over in order to win the war, whatever that looks like.
Yeah. So yeah. Maybe Otto is just stalling until he gets more troops in place, because it's going to take a while to get from the Reach all the way up there to the Riverlands. It's going to take a while for Tywin's group coming from the Westerlands to come all the way in. And I think he said through the Golden Tooth, which would place him not too far from the God's Eye Lake, right?
Yeah.
Not to get too nerdy about it. Sorry.
Yeah.
No. This is good stuff. Right. I mean, love it.
I mean, even those 2,000 troops coming from the wall, you know, we know that the journey from the wall to whatchamacallit, I always thought it took like a month for the wall to Winterfell, and then Winterfell to King's Landing was another month.
Yeah.
So, you know.
So how do you think Jason and Torrin got there? It had only been days since the Luke thing had happened by the time it caught up. So did Torrin hop on the back of a dragon
and fly
up there?
Yeah, he flew.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well,
that works.
Littlefinger showed them the way.
That's the joke that I made on my podcast, Axel. It's like, we're doing teleporting again, which I'm totally cool with, but we're doing teleporting again.
Yeah.
And also, it just dawned on me that Cregan mentioned that when, Jaehaerys and Alysanne came to the wall, their dragons wouldn't cross. Yes. Why did Dany's dragons not have any problem in the series proper? Did Dave and Dan not read the books, or did Ryan Condal not read the books? Who didn't read the books?
It's a good question, Matt. It's a good question. I guess we're going to have a whole podcast dedicated to that next week on House of the Dragon. I did want to bring up something, which is, it's a very quick scene, but we're introduced to a new character, Alan, with the sea snake. He's the guy who pulled him out of the water. And for those who were huge fans of an amazing show, which was canceled way too soon, which is, of course, oh God, I loved it so much, Raised by Wolves on HBO, HBO Max. The actor's name is Abu Bakr Salim, and he plays this character, Alan. And right away, I was like, yes! I love this guy.
Was that Father from Raised by Wolves?
Yeah.
Wow, he's bulked up.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's him.
He has. Well, he doesn't have to wear a shiny single suit anymore.
Yeah.
I have heard a rumor, and I don't mean to put in a spoiler, and you can cut this out if you want, Axel, but I've also heard that the mother has been casted for this season of Game of Thrones.
Nice.
I won't say for who, but we might see her as well.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I was
maybe a
happy.
Compensation for HBO canceling the show.
Perhaps the Lady of Harrenhal.
Well, we know that's the casting stays tight. We've seen, right? Like, how many times have you seen this before? It happens on like FX or HBO or Showtime, right? Where they keep casting the same people. And I'm cool with that because I love him. He was, if you haven't watched Raised by Wolves, it is one of the weirdest, strangest, most thrilling and oddest and fun shows. I absolutely loved it.
Ragnar is a spaceman.
Yeah, so good. So good. All right. Anybody, anything else? Are we good?
I think we're good on my end.
We're good. All right. Well, this has been a fantastic episode. Matt, thank you so much for coming on. Please tell us again where everyone can find you.
Okay. Well, you can find me being not Dame On, but Dame Off. And you can find me not being Kriston, but Kristoff.
Oh.
At Before the Dragon podcast. So I will be happy to field any feedback that you have, or you can say, hey, I heard you on Podcast Winterfell. You're still an idiot. I'm not going to listen to this podcast. Or you can come in and chime in our community. We started the fan call-in shows again, Axel. And that'll be coming out later this week. Yeah.
I'm excited. That's awesome. The old talk show days, baby. Recording is ended.
Yes, we do it by Zoom now, but it's no longer talk to you, but you can still actually call the Zoom call on Monday nights. And I would appreciate it if anybody who's listening to this and used to do that kind of thing with us at Podcast Winterfell would come back and see us when they get a chance or, you know, whatever. And of course, don't forget Double P Media at the word double the letters PHQ on the socials and at the word double the letter the word media on YouTube, where Bubba and Catfish totally destroy my musical segments every single week. Now, I love Bubba and Catfish. Thanks for having me, Axel. This has been so much fun and a great conversation. Gina, as usual, your shiningness of perception and smartness blesses this podcast. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. We wouldn't be here without you, buddy. Gina, any final words?
I don't think so. Just looking forward to the doom and gloom of next week.
Oh.
Because there's going to be a lot of blowback. So we'll see how it all kind of goes over. But it's going to be crunchy. Hopefully not dragon eating person crunchy.
We'll see. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. Check us out, dvrpodcast.com, patreon.com/DVR. Email us, dvrpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. Peace out.